So I would like to start this evening's talk by going back to quotation that I used in our opening evening from the historical Buddha, because it frames, I think, what John was talking about last night and what I'm hoping that this talk will be kind of a complement and continuation. And the historical Buddha said that he knew of no other single thing so conducive to misery than an untrained mind, and that he knew of no other single thing so conducive to satisfaction and happiness than a well-trained mind. So this really came home to me recently, and I'm going to change the facts of this just a little bit, but and several people here were at what I'm about to talk about. I attended a weekend retreat for people who are interested in bringing the Dharma into California prisons. And my role in that, what I've been doing, is I've done some work with the prisoners themselves, not a lot, but some, and I've done a lot of work, and I continue to do this with the therapists who actually provide services to the men. And a week from Tuesday, I start an 8-week series for 30 therapists in SAC Folsom Prison, which is now the mental health center for California prisons. You know, that's where it is. And I've done 30 hours of shadowing of therapists because I did a 5-week series last year, and I had in my mind what would be helpful. And it was. But it was actually more helpful just to the therapists, I think, than anything else. You know, I'm convinced that if you work in a prison, even though you leave at night, you're still in prison. And all of them, and I think they would agree with this, at some level are suffering from secondary trauma with, you know, everything that happens. And if I described, which I'm not at the moment, some of the conditions that they work under, they're just, it's, I think, impossible. I don't know how you maintain your humanness, actually. So the reason I've done all this shadowing was I wanted to get a real idea of what they are actually doing as opposed to what I think they're doing, right? And I want to do this training in a way that it's actually, in some sense, similar to what we're doing, that it's at a very foundational level, so that they can build a practice, and it's at such a level that they can turn right around and start introducing it to their clients. That's my goal anyway. So at this retreat, there was a prisoner there who's recently left, and it turned out that I knew him. He has been in a number of different prisons, but he'd been at Folsom, and about 12, 15 years ago, he had found the Dharma and had been a very devoted practitioner. And when you would go out, he would be the person who would be kind of your point person. And he was great. I mean, he was upbeat, and he was helpful, enthusiastic, and he wanted to learn and everything. You know. So he's gotten out. He's in Southern California, and he was invited down to participate in this, is to kind of act as a sounding board, you know, because there's, in the same way that I have all these ideas of what's helpful to the therapists, you know, the volunteers have all kinds of ideas of what's helpful to the prisoners, right? And so most of the time, you know, he would say, yeah, that would be very helpful. And then sometimes you could just see that it's like, wow, that's just, you don't get it at all. You know, there's all these dynamics that you don't understand. So it's fascinating. This is a man who's 52 years old. He's been in prison for 37 years. Okay. So the first morning of the retreat, I'm sitting at breakfast with several people, and one of the leaders of the retreat comes up and says to one of the people at the table, where's William? I'm using William as the name of this person, the prisoner, ex-prisoner. And the person says, well, I'm not sure where he is, you know. And I guess that person had been kind of hosting him. So you could see that the leader, co-leader, was kind of frustrated and kind of flustered and anxious, and she took off. And then things start and what have you. And later she comes up to me and says, do you know where I found William? And I said, no, where did you find him? And he said, well, he had gotten dressed and he was sitting on his bunk. And this is up at the Institute of Noetic Sciences off of Highway 101 here. And so the sleeping is kind of up the hill. It's a little bit of a distance, right? So everybody's coming down for breakfast. And he's up in the sleeping units, sitting on the side of his bed, waiting for someone to come to tell him what to do. And he seemed very open, you know, he's like very jovial, he's happy to be out of prison, he's upbeat, everything. And so I hesitated, and then I said, well, I'm just going to talk with him about this. And I got him, you know, off to the side at a break, and I said, talk to me about that. You know, I mean, were you just like resting, or like were you literally there waiting for somebody? And he said, I've been in prison for 37 years, and for 37 years, I've had someone tell me when to go to sleep, when I could get up, when I could go to the exercise yard, what kind of toilet paper I could use, what I can eat. And he said, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know if I was supposed to stay there or come down or somebody. So here it, in my estimation, is an illustration of a terribly well-trained mind in a way that we would never want to train a mind. You know, it speaks volumes about our prison system and, you know, why almost everybody goes back to prison once they're let out. So the theme of awakening that John set is intimately tied with that quotation from the Buddha to how we train our mind, how carefully we train our mind, and how deeply we train our mind. And just listening to the practice interviews today, I think we need to give ourselves a break. I mean, I think we need to lighten up a little bit. And in the end, I think this practice should be a joy. And how we frame what we're doing, I believe, is part of this. So last year when I was here, I started sitting in the chair last year because even though my left knee, I'd had a knee replacement surgery, I was still able to sit on the floor. And then my right knee, it's just all genetics, right? I could barely walk. Last year when I was here, I had to take the elevator. I couldn't use the stairs. So we went on pilgrimage 10 days after this retreat last year. And then I got back and had my full knee replacement in March. So I'm actually going to talk about it in relationship to pain in the body and the mind and causation. It's a topic I'm excited about. In two nights. It's odd, but the experience I had, of the whole experience, was like this very positive experience. You know, you hear everybody talk about being in the hospital. I had a great time. You know? And so at one point, I think this was the morning I left, they took me down to x-rays. They put you on a gurney, you know, so that they don't, you don't have to get out and put on a chair. Take it down. I get in, and the man who comes out to help me is a man named Rufus McCurry. And Rufus, my guess is in his late 40s or early 50s, and he's very jovial. And he's got this well-rehearsed, well-worn routine that he does. And I don't mean that demeaningly at all. I mean, it is very, very thoughtful. This guy's a little special soul in disguise. And it's all designed to put you at ease, you know, and because a lot of people come down there who are, you know, really miserable and fearful. And so we kind of get into this banter, and it's all designed to take you away from your pain, okay? You know, it's just like his golf game and this, that, what have you. And, you know, I said to him, well, how was your golf game? And he says, well, he says, you know, my golf game is the most troubling relationship I've ever had, other than with my wife. You know, it's that kind of stuff, right? I mean, it, you know, in any other context, it would be corny. And there, you know, when you're kind of feeling vulnerable and at risk, it's endearing, you know. So we do the x-rays. He goes out. He tells me he's going to leave me. And he's going to go call to have somebody come pick me up. And I'm basically in the dark in this room, and I get what, you know, there's a lot of names for it, but it's basically the spiking pain, and the pain had been quite good, but the spiking pain just takes you out. I mean, it's unbelievable, you know, and on a surgery like this, you know, like they're carpenters, right? I mean, like they you know, they cut off the top of your knee, literally, you know, and put a thing, you know, and then they cut off the bottom, and, you know, they're using mallets, and, you know, so there's a lot going on down there, you know, trying to heal, and then you get one of these spiking pains, and you either pass out, you start crying, or you start laughing, you know, it's like, oh, I can't believe how bad this is, you know, so that's what started happening, and he heard me, and they're kind of laughing and talking to myself. So he sticks his head around the corner and he says, "Hey, man, are you okay?" And I said, yeah, I'm fine. It's just that spiking pain stuff, right? And he goes, yeah. He says, but just remember, from here on out, it's all healing pain. Okay? You know, from here on out, it's all healing pain. And it was extraordinary. You know, like, I'd had, like, this great stay. And then this happened, and like just instantaneously, all of your fear and everything just, you know, just explodes. And here this guy comes in and says that, and it was so soothing and so comforting, and then also completely framing actually what you know, I mean, it's not like some shtick. It's for real, right? And so that's really become a metaphor for me, you know, because that's what I believe that we are doing here. That's what I believe this practice is all about. It's about healing ourselves in so many ways and in the deepest way possible, and that's what awakening is about. So if that is true, and I believe that it is, what we're doing here should be like a source of inspiration and joy for us. And we were talking in the groups earlier today about how, you know, you can have one of two reactions. You know, you can see something, actually have a moment where you really see something clearly, like a habit that is really painful or dysfunctional. And you can have two reactions. You know, you can go, oh, God, look, I can't believe that, you know, and feel some guilt or shame or feel defeated. Or you can just go, wow, that is unbelievable. Look at that. I mean, like, for the first time in my life, I actually see that clearly. And now I have an opportunity to do something with it. Yeah. So we want to try to shift to the other. I think we're habitually conditioned to do the first. You know, it's like, if it's bad, man, it's bad, right? But if in fact that this is healing, then those kinds of insights are something, I mean, all kinds of things. They're beautiful. They're potentially liberating. You know, they're inspiring. They're the source of interest and curiosity. Like, man, I want to go there, right? That's going to take me home. So I just want to encourage us to reframe, if we haven't already, what we're doing here, because I think it really can help us lighten things up. And to use a kind of a humbling illustration of this, which I used in one group earlier today. But I thought, well, I'll just humiliate myself in front of the whole group. yesterday afternoon, you know, we're all sitting here, and well, it's when we were all in the room. I'm not sure what time it was. We're all in the room, and I'm sitting here, and you know, your mind seems like it's very clear, you know, and really settled. You know, I was seeing things clearly. And then I'm sitting here, and like all of a sudden, I notice kind of like my mind starts thinking. And then I'm not going to give you the details of this, okay? But I start noticing the thoughts that my mind are thinking, and from the standpoint of the precepts, they're just not the thing that you would think that the teacher sitting here would be thinking, okay? To be clear, it's not about anyone in the room, okay? But it, you know, it's like, wow, look at that. You know, like, where did that come from? So you know to come back to your breath, you know, nice and calm, you know, seeps back in again. This happens 3 or 4 times. And then at some point I looked at, and so you could go, oh my gosh, you know, this is, I can't believe that, you know, that's so bad, or feel shame or guilt or something. And I just looked at it, and my reaction was, that is so preposterous. You know, look where I'm sitting, and that's what I'm thinking, or my mind's thinking. And I just started laughing. You know, it's like, yeah, this is just ridiculous. You know? So, and I think that's an appropriate response. You know? I think we've shamed ourselves and made ourselves guilty enough. You know? We just don't need to do that. We need to see clearly, and then engage what we're experiencing with this practice and heal ourselves. You know? So where to start? And we're going to start with the Satipatthana Sutta. I'm hoping to get there. But but this idea about reframing and everything, for me, you know, I think if you're confused about what you're doing practice-wise, it's always wise to go all the way back to the basics, the foundations. And for me, that takes us all the way back to our intention. Because the Buddha said that, you know, our intention is our prime driver, right? Of our thoughts, emotions, everything. And I find his life and his practice instructive on this. So if you look at the Buddha, you know, leaves his family, begins this practice, and the first thing he does is practice with two of the best known teachers of the day, who both basically were concentration teachers. And he plumbs these rarefied, exquisite states of concentration where everything disappears, basically. You know, your sense of your body and all of your sense doors shut down, everything disappears, and you enter these rarefied states. And when he would come back out, what he, after practicing for several years, he realized that he couldn't maintain it, even though he had become very sophisticated, that he would have certain experiences and he would see a ripple in his mind of aversion or desire. And there's this one sutta that's very telling where he goes back to one of the teachers and basically is testing the teacher, and describes to the teacher his experience in great detail, and asks the teacher, does this mean that I'm awakened? And the teacher says, yes, it does. You know, it's happened. And the Buddha knew that this teacher was no longer his teacher, because he knew that that was not true, that he hadn't awakened, that his mind had not been purified. So he leaves that kind of practice and starts practicing in these practices, which are broadly referred to as Shramana practices. They're austerity practices, which I'm going to talk about in a couple of nights. And he went to the extreme end of these practices. So, you know, you've seen the pictures or the statues or read the sutta where, you know, the Buddha is basically emaciated. And so these were practices of serious, big-time denial of the body. And the idea was to completely isolate yourself from the sense doors. So the concentration practices did that, but they did it in a very pleasant way. These practices were designed to basically seeing the body and the sense doors as the enemy. And so you would engage in all of these extreme practices. And there's one sutta where he describes them about, you know, sleeping on a bed of nails and, you know, only eating one piece of rice a day and on and on and on. So at some point he then realizes that that is not taking him in the right direction. And he's not sure where to go, but he knows that the strict concentration practices and these austerities are not it. And kind of in his day, there, and you know, it was a hotbed of spiritual exploration, but one of the people that he perceived as kind of his major rivals was the teacher of the Jain, what became the Jain movement. Okay? And the Jains believed that this kind of practice, these extreme austerities, where you were controlling your action, was the key to consequences in the future, your karma and awakening. Not your intention, but your action. So you could have an inappropriate intention, but if your action was morally appropriate, it was okay. That would have the right consequence. And of course the Buddha said, you know, this is where they parted company. And he said, absolutely not. Your intention is everything, because it will drive your action. And acting in a certain way but having the wrong intention is almost as bad as the inappropriate action. So this is really, for me, an interesting issue, because you would think that all of us, you know, studying the Dharma, wanting to practice the Dharma, would understand what right intention is, somehow intuitively, you know, and what right action is. And anybody who has practiced for any time at all knows that basically we're confused. I mean, seriously confused about why we suffer and the way out of suffering, you know? I mean, like, if we actually knew that, we probably wouldn't be at this retreat. So the right intention has to be reflected upon and cultivated, and it has to be developed. So I was, you know, an illustration that you'll hear sometimes that I like just because it's dramatic, is of a sniper. And you know, a sniper is a long-range rifle and is, you know, doing everything that we do, right? So they know the quality of their breath. You know, they allow it to settle. They know what their thought is, what their emotion, they count themselves. And, you know. And there's a movie out called American Sniper, and the trailer on it is kind of dramatic to catch your attention, and this is Bradley Cooper, and it shows Bradley Cooper doing exactly that, you know, completely setting himself and calming himself, and then you see through his scope, and this is in Iraq, or, you know, one of the countries we've destroyed, and there's a woman walking down the street, and then just the way they do it, you get it that he's watching her because he thinks that she may, you know, like, have a weapon or a bomb. She's got a boy with him that's maybe 9, 10, 11 years old. And then what unfolds is he begins to focus on the little boy, and it turns out that the little boy actually does have a bomb. And then, you know, they cut away right then, and So you have to go see the movie. What happened? You know, that's frightful. And if you haven't seen it, you're probably not going to want to see it. And to save you the suspense, he does pull the trigger and kill the little boy. And this is about a true person who has the most kills of any American sniper, something like 110 or 135. And he says he's proud of every single one of them, you know, that he was serving his country. So this relates to me about, you know, intention and right action or right intention. I'm of that era when I was in college, everyone was either going off to the Vietnam War or trying to get a deferment, you know. And in junior high school and high school, I had been a baseball player and a pitcher, and all that time, in Little League before that, I had the same catcher the entire time. A great guy, just a wonderful guy. And he was gung-ho, and he didn't want a deferment. He wanted to go to Vietnam, and he did. And he became one of these long-range snipers, you know. And there what they would do is take them, and they would drop them. There's two of them, you know. There's a spotter and a shooter, and they would drop them down behind enemy lines and leave them there for a week. And they would, you know, live in trees and what have you. And their whole purpose was just to wait there to see if they could get a long-range shot. So I remember there's a big story in the news and in Time magazine about one of these American snipers. And, you know, to make a shot that's like a mile long, they have to calculate. They actually have to shoot the bullet in an arc to hit the target. You know, it's extraordinary that they can figure this all out, but that's the role of the spotter. You know, they figure all out and this whole trajectory. So they were reporting, you know, that some of these guys could shoot, you know, like out at a mile in 0.2. So there's this story in the news that the top general of the opposition had been killed by a sniper by one bullet, and that the shot was 1.8 miles long. Almost inconceivable. Like people just, you know, people still talk about that. So flash forward a couple of years, and I see my buddy, you know, in a restaurant, and it's like, hey man, how are you? You know, it's great to see you. And you're, oh, I'm back from the war. And let's get together. Make a long story short, this is the guy who made the shot. Okay. And he had a well-trained mind. You know, they had trained him to serve his country and to believe that killing another human being in the service of your country was not just a good thing, but a great thing. And he had been excellent at it. And now, back stateside, he was riddled with guilt and shame. And he had allowed someone to train him in a way that overrode his true intentions about other people, you know. So, yeah, that's a very telling story for me, because not that anybody in here is going to kill someone else, but all of us can think of times when we were probably completely convinced that we were doing the right thing, only to wake up later and realize that we were really deluded, and that we were being driven by desire or aversion, and, you know, our deepest intentions about being fair to people in the world and being kind and compassionate had been completely overridden by desire and aversion. And so the relationship between the strength of those forces, which are always deluding us, and training in a very clear way, so that when they do start to become powerful, our training is strong enough to stand up to those, you know, not with force, but with wisdom, is how I understand the practice. So John last night, I want to thank John for his talk and outlining so carefully the Satipatthana Sutra and that path, because it's important that we all understand that path. And I would like to supplement that. And the way that I understand this is that the Satipatthana Sutra lays out these four fields, which are basically energetic fields in which we can practice, and different, it lays out different practices. And then what I'm going to talk about are just two things. And those two things are refrains which appear over and over again. And sometimes you see refrains that appear over and over again just as an oral tool because it was an oral tradition. The belief is that these are not repeated merely as a memory tool, that they are repeated as an instruction of how to use the practices in the Four Foundations. Okay? You understand this? Okay, so there's two of them. One of them is repeated 14 times, and the other one is repeated 16 times. Mm-hmm. So if they're right, that that's what the Buddha meant, it's like, wow, these must be pretty important, okay? And I think when you hear them and then think about John's speech, they frame everything. And both of them are going to sound really familiar, and I want us to hold this with the idea of, like, we can lighten up even about this stuff, okay? Because I think particularly the first one makes people kind of ratchet down a little bit. How's that for an introduction? Okay, so the first one is about what I talked about on the first morning, and that is observing and knowing what we're experiencing. Okay, and so there's different ways that, you know, the language is in the Satipatthana is interpreted, but this is one of them. And so it says the yogi, and that's any one of us, dwells observing and knowing the phenomena arising in the body. That we actually see it arising. Okay. The yogi dwells observing and knowing the phenomena being sustained. The yogi dwells observing and knowing the phenomena passing away in the body. And the first thing that I think is noteworthy about this is all of these end with in the body. So it's talking about the first foundation, which is the breath in the body, the feeling tone of experience, thoughts, and emotion. And the instruction is that you're seeing all of this in the body, right? Okay. That it's a body-based practice. So what is this? What does it mean? Why is it important? So I guess the starting place is to understand that from one perspective, it's numerous things, but from one perspective, it's an approach, it's a method, it's a tool of inquiry, of experiential inquiry. But the important part is, what is it designed to do? You know, I'm seeing something arise, I'm seeing something sustain, I'm seeing something pass away. And what it's designed to do is to get behind, get underneath whatever, however you want to frame this, underneath, behind, over our habitual states of mind that control how we're thinking and feeling and reacting. That we have these deeply ingrained habits which we're all experiencing in the last couple of days. You know, that we want things a certain way, we don't want things a certain way, that we believe something about ourselves, we believe we can do something, we believe we can't do something, on and on and on. Beliefs, assumptions, projections that we make, fears. And this is trying to go behind those. And what it's trying to look at is the process that makes them arise, stay there, and disappear. In other words, not going into content and not going into meaning. That those are the hooks. You know, it's like fishing, right? It's like, I'm not a fisherman, but I had a buddy who loved to fish, so I'd go catch and release with him, and we'd go bass fishing. You know, and I always found it kind of thrilling because, you know, you'd throw that out, and then with bass fishing, it's not just dropping the line in the water. You throw it out, and then you reel it in, and there's a lure. And the lure has the shiny thing on it, and the fish sees it and goes after it, you know. And you'd be doing this, and that fish would hit that thing. It's quite dramatic, you know. So in the kind of work we're doing here on retreat, the lure is meaning... It's like the mind wanting to go out of the experience that is here, and like, what does it mean intellectually? Where did it come from? Did that happen when I was a child? Or is that because of that thing that my husband said to me, my wife did to me? So it's designed to keep us at a process level and watch things arise, be sustained, and disappear. So there's this neutrality about it, right? Once we go into meaning, almost always, it's accompanied by a whole set of emotional baggage. And so what we're trying to look at is the universal mechanism that is at work that makes us suffer. And what we start to find out is that if it's aversion, the, quote, cause of it that we can identify, you know, whether it's in our childhood or our family history or our personal narrative or whatever you want to name, if it's aversion, it always acts the same way. Now, it may light up much quicker, it may be more powerful, but the mechanism of how aversion rolls out, how it arises, how it's sustained, and how it is going to be the same. So this is what we're trying to see. We're trying to see beneath all the conventional way that we suffer and go down at this deeper level. So we can get all kinds of temporary relief from addressing things at a conventional level and manage our aversion or our desire or our anger. And it doesn't solve it. And it's important to learn how to do that. And that's part of this practice. But if we're talking about liberation, about getting free, really getting free, and kind of reconstructing the mind, it's this completely neutral process of looking at how aversion, desire, whatever it is, acts, and then learning how to deal with it. That is the thing that begins to set the mind free and undermines the hold of these on the mind. And the interesting part about this is we live in a society, and I think we're compulsively trained to do something. So in the practice interviews, if people don't say it, it's implied that, well, you know, I'm feeling a certain way and I don't like it. What do I do to solve it? What do I do to make it go away? What do I do? You know? And from this perspective, the answer is you don't do anything. You know, you stay there with it, and you learn how not to be compelled to do something. And the reason you want to do that is that if you do that, it leads to understanding, and the understanding is what gives you insight. So the whole purpose of this, these inquiries, you know, isn't just some exercise in and of itself. It's to lead to a deep experiential understanding of what causes us to suffer and what leads our mind towards satisfaction and happiness. So to the degree that, and you know, none of this, it's all gradual, right? You know, it's not like overnight we can just be there with something that's really troubling. We do it in little bits, but the goal is to learn how to be present with something and not need to do anything about it. And this is an extraordinary skill. Yeah. And the other thing that this is, you know, it's a method, it's a tool, it's an approach, is I think this is the fundamental inquiries of Buddhist practice and Buddhist psychology. You know, when all said and done, what are the four foundations and what are the four noble truths about? We suffer. Why do we suffer? There's a solution to the suffering. And these are the fundamental underlying questions, experiential questions, that lead to that understanding. So over and over in that sutta, the sutta talks about practices with the body and then says, with these three experiential questions, it talks about feeling tone, with these three questions. He talks about thoughts with you. So it leads us someplace. And then the last piece of what I think this is, and I think we have to reflect on this, is that if it's true that this is healing practice, and if it's true that some real part of our intention is to get free, these three questions should be our deepest aspiration as practitioners. We should want to know the answers to these questions badly, deeply, profoundly, because if we do know the answer to them, they're going to start to take us in a particular direction with our practice. So they should be an aspiration, a source of inspiration. We should be curious, like, why is it that really, I mean, really, we suffer? And once we actually generate interest about these kinds of questions, that generates energy. And we suddenly have this whole new effort. So I know in some of the groups, and there's always the idea that, like, these questions are, like, experientially, to ask these questions are really difficult. They're really hard. You know, like, this is real work. And back to this idea, I think we just have to frame it and lighten up a little bit. I don't think they are. I think they feel that way because we haven't trained ourselves to do this. So it's a question of training. And the analogy for me is this morning I was sitting right out here having breakfast and I looked over at this. There's a bush right here that's completely unspectacular. And so I was kind of looking at it, and I noticed that, you know, you see the impression of the bush. So I just started looking at it, and then it's like I kind of got interested in it, and I saw the stem. You know, and then once I saw the stem, I started seeing all kinds of things. You know, I saw all of the different branches leading off. Started noticing that certain parts of the leaves on some of the branches were different. And just, you know, amazing, all that was there. The moment before, all I saw was the big impression of the bush. So, and I encourage you to try this yourself. And I was thinking, like, okay, how can I will this work? And what I'd say is, take any bush out here, or out in the garden, and look at it, and then, you know, just, and what will happen is, you know, you'll see an impression of the bush. And then look at it as if you were going to come back here and describe it. Or if you were going to sketch it. Okay? So it's not like, oh my gosh, you know, I've got it. It's like, well, see this? You know, curiosity. And just watch what happens. Just that little shift, you will suddenly, an investigation will start. And it will be easy. So that's what this is about. It's the same thing. It's like, you know, I'm in the middle of feeling really terrible, you know, on the cushion. Look like, okay, what's going on? You know, where is it? Is it rising right now? You know, is it something that I've been feeling for a while? Is it starting to dissipate? And then just watch with the intention of seeing one of those three things. So maybe it's like, well, and you don't have to exhaust yourself. Maybe the way you do this is, like in a sitting, you you just say, okay, I'm going to spend a third of every sitting trying to train my mind on this. So I'm just going to watch and see if I can watch when something arises or when it's arising. That's it, you know. Or I'm going to watch and see if I can see when it's dissipating or when it disappears. And what does it feel like when it disappears? Because when it disappears, usually, it's a relief. Unless it's happiness. But you follow me here? I mean, this doesn't have to be like, oh my gosh, you know, arising, all these things, like these three questions. It's like, no, there's three issues, and we just slowly begin to train our mind. It's a training. And if we don't try to train our mind, it's not going to happen just spontaneously, usually. Okay, so that, and I think we really need to reflect, do it is the reason we're here. Do we really want to get free? And will these questions really help with that? You know, I mean, you reflect in a very deep way. And if the answer to that is yes, we'll want to explore those questions, you know? Okay. So that's the first one. Second one is, the first one actually sounds hard, and I think that actually in the end it's just a question of training, and you can pick it up and it'll start to produce real results for you. The second one is a little harder, probably a little easier to practice with, but it is a very big ticket. And this is giving up. The Buddha talks about this 16 times, the refrain 16 times. This is about giving up on holding on to things. In other words, attachment. Okay? It's not a very big refrain, but it's after each one of the sections, and it says, the yogi abides or dwells independently from external circumstances, not clinging to anything in this world. Okay? The yogi abides independently, not clinging to anything in this world. And traditionally, attachment is described in four categories. One is a sensuous desire. Okay, so anything from any sense door where desire arises. You know, I want something. And actually, it's even, I don't want it. But it's sensuous desire. Okay. The second one is views, which could include a belief, an opinion, you know, that are fixed. Okay, so this is something that I think is true, or I know to be true, or that I believe or I assume about a situation or about you. The third one is traditionally called rules and rituals. Originally, it was referring to, and I'll talk about this in a couple of nights, about the Vedic practices where the Brahmin priests were in complete control of whether or not you would get into the promised land, basically. That it had nothing to do with your own individual effort, that the Brahmic priests did rites and rituals in secret, and everyone had to pay them for them. And then you were completely dependent on them for your freedom. Now this is, you know, interpreted as rules or rituals, so all of our habituated or habitual conduct. And the fourth one is personality belief, the belief in a separate and distinct permanent personality. And when I first looked at these, I said to myself, well, gee, that pretty much sums up my whole life. Like, what's left, you know? So all of practice I view from like an energy or an energetic standpoint, and the energetic nature of attachment, dependent origination, the process of how we become reactive and how we become attached and identified, it rolls out in a particular way, and it basically has with the mind starting to desire something. And, you know, if you were to imagine, well, if there's something in the middle of my hands, and the strength of the desire just keeps increasing, and then it wraps itself around something and holds on to it, right? And then the intensity of that holding on at some point causes us to identify with whatever it is. Okay? So we can become attached to an idea, a thought, a belief, an assumption, a material object, a hope, a person. You know, we can become attached to almost anything. And then the problem is that once we actually lock down on it and it becomes habitual, it becomes, from the standpoint of Buddhist psychology, it becomes what's called a mental formation or sankhara. And the problem with this is that it is embedded. The Buddha called it a knot. And it's in the body and the mind, and it is sitting there waiting to be activated. And we all know this to be true, right? I mean, we all have the experience, like, going along, having a great day, somebody calls up, not our favorite person, and says something to us that, you know, in the past, we've always objected to, they say it again, and we're like, boom, right? All of a sudden, it's just like an explosion. Well, that's a mental formation exploding, basically, okay? It's like embedded, just waiting to be activated. And it starts with this attachment and then this attachment reifying or hardening. So, you know, what do we do about it? For me, the first piece is looking at, well, all the way back to intention, like, well, what really is our deepest intention? And if you look at the way the Buddha structured the historical Sangha, it's, I think, deceptively simple, and we kind of overlook what was going on, because the Sangha and many of the procedures in it were striking right at this, right at the issue of attachment, and then attachment moving up to identification. So what's the first thing that happens if you ordain and go into a monastery? Okay. You walk in and, you know, it's me, let's say. Okay, walk in, got Aloha shirt on. Okay. And so the first thing that probably happens is that they laugh at you. Okay? So the second thing that happens is they say, take your Aloha shirt off. And here is a robe. Actually, here's two robes and a bowl. And that's it. So your whole identity around clothing and possessions suddenly is taken away from you. You know, is what? Abandoned. That's the traditional language. What's the next thing that happens? Okay, so I said this earlier in the group today. I said, they really insult you. And I said, it isn't going to be much of an insult to me pretty soon, but they shave your head. Yeah. So your whole identity in relationship to your appearance, now that's gone. So your clothing, here's gone. What's the next thing? All these things that you think about yourself that are really the things that define who you are. And in the Buddhist time, since there was a caste system, you know, there were four castes, and then there was, well, you know, there's the untouchables. And they called them outcasts. The reason they called them outcasts is they were considered so lowly, they didn't even get to be called a caste. Okay? So being, and this eventually became part of the Hindu religion. Okay, so there's the priests, there's the warriors, there's the businessmen and farmers, and there's slaves. Okay? So your place in one of these castes was huge. So you move from a society with that as the basis, and you come there, and it's like, well, we don't care about your status, we don't care about your power, we don't care about your privilege, we don't care about your money. Here, it is completely irrelevant. And so it was structured, the structure, and you know, we could keep going. There's many other things that happen. But you can just see fundamentally that this is an absolute leveling of the spiritual playing field. the Buddha invited untouchables into the community. You know? So it's a complete leveling, and it's an attack on people's attachment to what? To who they think they are. And why they think they're special. And why they think they have privilege. Exactly what those three questions are trying to get behind. The other thing that isn't talked about very much, but it's very clear, and I think it's a huge message, and I want you to hear all of this before you get reactive around it, okay? Is this idea of abandonment, in the sense of not that it, you know, I mean, people clearly still have families, but you're abandoning your attachment to the family. You know, you're abandoning your attachment to privilege. The other thing that clearly was being abandoned was your attachment to your family history and your personal narrative and your personal story. You will not read a sutta that talks about how to deal with some trauma that you had earlier in your life or anything at all in that nature. And once again, there was an absolute leveling. And not that those things are unimportant, but the way that they should be treated is the same as every other form of aversion, desire, or reactivity. So something comes up right now for any of us. Right now, here it is. And the soul question is, what do I do with it now? So whether the aversion is arising because of my butt hurting or because of indigestion from the meal that I had this morning or the fact that a thought just came in my mind about something that a member of my family did to me last year, that's aversion. And we're looking at the process of suffering, not the content. So the answer isn't in plumbing the whole story about, well, gee, let's go back and completely review breakfast. That's not the answer. Breakfast is over. Right now, I'm aversive to the experience I'm having in my stomach. How it happened this morning, at least for the moment, on the question of I'm suffering, is irrelevant. Now, it may be pretty wise to go back and think about what you ate and adjust your eating, but that's a different issue. If we're talking about suffering, you know, I'm suffering right now. So, aversion, desire, anger, frustration, lust, whatever it is, they all have these commonalities of patterns and what? The way they arise, the way they are sustained, the way they pass away. And so what is causing the aversion is not the issue. It's the process of the aversion and the process that we engage that with. Okay? So this for me is like a very powerful message. I'm going to express probably for some people an unpopular belief right now. I believe that we have a situation right now where Buddhism and or what people call Buddhism and mindfulness and what people call mindfulness, which isn't frequently, a lot of people are picking it up, not really understanding what it is, and actually their practice makes them suffer more because it makes them feel that they're special because of their suffering, that they have all these special ways that they suffer that are so unique to them. And that makes me special, and it makes my suffering special, and it's another way, it's another form of narcissism and another form of reifying the self. You know, that what this is about is, well, I have to fix myself. That's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to see into a process that's arising from causes and conditions, not fix something. So I think the issue of training and really understanding what we're doing, and like this whole process of like, okay, we're going all the way back to basics. Why do we do that? And for me, in part, it's because of this, that like we re-clarify what the true intention of what we're doing and how we're doing it is. It's really easy to get kind of a little bit lost, a little bit confused, you know, a little bit off base. And these retreats, in some respect, are like bringing us back onto a very clear path. So I know that this idea about we'll just stay here and just deal with what's present is, I think, for our culture, like a radical idea. You know, there's all that, you know, everybody's using radical, but, you know, in book titles to sell books, you know. But, I mean, it is. I mean, like, we are not trained. We have been trained in this culture to think a certain way, and it is not this. And so the idea of just stay here, just keep watching, learn how to stay here rather than run away from it, deny it, avoid it, go numb. Just keep watching it, and it will reveal itself, is a foreign idea. And it is the nature of this practice. Okay? We do not have to move into an intellectual exploration for insight to arise. Because this insight that arises in this practice is intuitive and experiential. And the trying to think our way into it actually cuts off the process. Just the reverse of what you think. So this is a very powerful process, and also one that really requires some diligence on our part. Like we want to be able to see into the nature of things this way. We actually have to have the intention to do it. I think the only way that we can have that intention is if we really reflect on this. And then that we actually build it into our practice. So, once again, I mean, we don't have to make this, like, labor. I mean, I think that this can be, like, really fascinating, you know, and just start watching, you know, like, a certain part of your sitting, a certain part of daily life, you're just going to devote it to, going to watch every time I'm holding on, you know? I don't have to do anything about it, okay? It's seeing it is the issue. And then you begin to see it. Okay, how does it feel? Okay. In the body. Okay. And then see it. Yeah, it feels. Okay. How does it work? What causes the attachment to come up? What causes the attachment to disappear? Okay. So we're just doing an exploration. And then if we actually begin to see those things, our conduct starts to change. Our thinking starts to change because we understand it differently. So, back to William the prisoner. I think it would be easy to hear that story and think that that is, you know, a sad story about a terrible thing that is abnormal. And at some level it's true, because somebody does something and our system puts them in this institution and then they are controlled by other people. I actually don't think that that story is all that different than many of the things that you and I are dealing with. I mean, the message of Buddhist practice is we individually are solely responsible for what we do with our states of mind and our actions. You know, it's unflinching. Buddhist practice, it gives us, it does not give us the luxury of blaming somebody for what we're feeling. It doesn't matter what the provocation is. It doesn't matter if they're nasty or unreal, or everybody that we know would agree that something has happened to you that is unfair. You and I are still solely responsible for what we do with that. And all of us, I mean, I think every single person in this room could talk about something that they have basically been imprisoned by their entire life. And so at some point, we have to wake up and take responsibility for that. We can't blame anybody anymore. And that the only way that we will get out of that prison is in this moment. You know, which is now this moment. And what I do in this moment is going to determine whether I get free from that or not. It's not going to happen at some time in the future. Because, I mean, literally, from a Buddhist perspective, there is no future. I mean, when we get to whatever the future is, it's still this moment right now. So to the degree that we, like, keep hoping that, well, I can get serious, you know, tomorrow. You know, or I'll start practicing next week, or whatever it is. Well, it's now, you know. So I think this is a deep reflection, you know. I mean, like, how deeply we really want to get free. You know, I think, in honesty, I think the way we're structured, and with these attachments, that there are very powerful portions of us that don't want to get free. That we want to be comfortable. That there are certain things that we don't want to challenge. And so I think just reflecting on this and do I really want to get free? You know, have I had enough of this? And if it's true that there's a life after this, do I really want to do this all over again next time? John and I were having a talk about this the other night. You know, I'm actually quoting John. It's funny, but I'm serious, right? It's like, you know, we're talking about what I also believe is that what Buddhist practice is about is answering the question of what it means to be a human being living on this planet, which is hanging in a universe which is beyond our comprehension. So these are the most profound questions that we can ask ourselves as human beings. So actually getting in touch with, do we really want to get free? And are these the tools that will help us get free? If we can, and then reflect on that, and then that leads, the intention leads to action, and then the action begins to change our practice and our thoughts and everything. So that's what I would encourage you to reflect on. So let's just sit just for a second, okay?